Over the life of the four-year contract, Pavano made only 26 starts and won just 9 games, or a cost of $4.44 million per win for the Yankees' investment. He missed extended stretches of time because of the sore shoulder, a bruised buttocks, 2 broken ribs suffered in a car accident about which he failed to notify the team, a strained elbow, and eventually major elbow surgery. His Yankees teammates wrote him off as a guy who milked any physical ailment as an excuse not to have to pitch. "The players all hated him," Torrey said. "It was no secret." Said Borzello, "Guys on that team despised him. One day Jeet walked by him and said, 'Hey, Pav, you ever going to play? Ever?' Wow." That was a damaging comment coming from Jeter. He didn't say a whole lot, but when he said something like that, it was pretty piercing. There was one time Torrey called bullpen coach Joe Kerrigan and Pavano into his office because Kerrigan reported that a defiant Pavano had told him, "I'm not blowing out my arm for this organization." "Pav," Torrey said, "this organization gave you $40 million and has been patient with you. What I want to know is, for what organization would you be willing to risk blowing out your arm?" Pavano said he couldn't remember saying such a thing to Kerrigan. What bothered Torrey most about Pavano was that the pitcher had no sense of his responsibility to his teammates. Pavano made that clear in 2006 when he hurt himself in the car wreck, when he drove his 2006 Porsche into a tractor trailer. The accident occurred just when the Yankees were about ready to activate him from a rehabilitation assignment. Torrey telephoned Pavano and told him, "It's nice to go out. I know you like to go out. But you've got a commitment here. You've got a bunch of players that need for you to be a pitcher." Pavano never did get it. "He was always a little skittish when you talked to him," Torrey said. At the end of that season, Cashman was ready to send Pavano home. The pitcher was on perpetual rehab in Tampa, and he wasn't going to be able to help the Yankees down the stretch. "No," Torrey told Cashman. "Have him come to St. Pete on the last road trip." Torrey knew Pavano's teammates loathed him, and he wanted them to be able to vent their frustration to the pitcher rather than carrying it over into a new season. He wanted Pavano in the Yankees clubhouse when the team played the Devil Rays in St. Petersburg. "Let them get this shit out of the way," Torrey told Cashman. "They can see him, get on him, whatever they're going to do to him." Cashman agreed and told Pavano to come to the games in St. Petersburg. When Pavano arrived, Torrey explained to him why he wanted him there. "You're going to have to get this shit out of the way," he told Pavano. When Pavano showed up in the Yankees clubhouse, something far worse than cruel jokes and frat boy razzing took place. Nothing. The Yankees said nothing to him. They wanted nothing to do with him. He had turned himself into a non-person. "Unfortunately, nobody got on him," Torrey said. "That's a bad sign. They ignored him." The next spring, Messina made it clear that the Yankee players had no confidence in Pavano. He told reporters about Pavano's injuries and extended absences. "It didn't look good from a player's and teammates' standpoint. Was everything just coincidence? Over and over again? I don't know." It was a stunning and rare public rebuke among teammates, a violation of the unwritten code among teammates. But Pavano was so far removed from the natural bonds of a team that Messina felt free to fire away. Torrey called both Messina and Pavano into his office. He knew Messina, in the strictest sense of the code, was out of line, but he also knew that Messina's feelings about Pavano represented the feelings of the entire clubhouse, and it was good for Pavano to know he faced major repair work when it came to his relationship with his teammates. "Moose didn't do the right thing, the way he went about it," Torrey said. "But they did talk, and they got past that, and all of a sudden he started to get some support back. Andy Pettit had elbow issues in 1996, and you just have to realize, I'm either going to pitch or I can't play this game anymore." Pav, unfortunately, never faced that reality. In saying that, am I saying he wasn't hurt? No, not at all. But would it have made a difference if he had pitched, based on where he wound up anyway? You're still capable of getting people out. He's a guy with all these issues in his life, and he's not sure what's important and what isn't. Was he afraid of failing in New York? It must be that way, because I talked to Larry Boa, and he saw the bulldog on the mound when he pitched against the Phillies, and I saw it in the World Series. We just didn't see that with the Yankees. Pavano was not some idle mistake. It was part of a trend. The collection of expensive pitchers imported to the Yankees, who were ill-suited for New York, either because they were too emotionally fragile or broken down, was growing at a staggering rate. Weaver, Contreras, Vasquez, Wright, Brown, Pavano. "I'm certainly not a player evaluator," Messina said, "but I generally believe that players are who they are over a period of a certain number of years. They may have a good year here, or they may have a bad year here, but in general they play at a certain level, the players who are around long enough. The time a player is coming up to be a free agent, like in his sixth year, let's say all of a sudden he has a year that shoots up. Everybody looks at it like, oh, now he's got an idea. It's not his rookie year. There are four or five other years in there. Let's look at all of them. So you're giving guys, and just using Pavano as an example, you give a guy that's two or three games under 500 for his career a four-year contract for $40 million. Well, I don't understand that. I don't understand that. Brown, of course, because of the 2004 ALCS Game 7 debacle, also was symbolic of poor pitching evaluations steering the Yankees into the abyss, as Cashman called it. His 2005 season began just as 2004 ended, with a bad back and awful results. He started 2005 on the disabled list, the fifth time in 6 years he had to be put on the shelf. When Brown did try to pitch again, he was wretchedly bad. He was, for all intents and purposes, finished as an effective big-league pitcher. Moreover, the fans at Yankee Stadium, who would always associate him with the Game 7 abomination, had no use for him, and his teammates barely more than that. On May 3, 2005, Brown took the mound in St. Petersburg against the Devil Rays with an 0-3 record and a 6.63 ERA. His tenure with the Yankees was about to get even uglier. The Devil Rays gave Brown a brutal beating in the first inning, scoring 6 runs on 8 hits before Brown could so much as get a second out. The symphony of hits and base runners played out to a staccato beat. Single, wild pitch, single, ground rule double, run scoring ground out, single, double, single, single, single. The score was 6-0 after 1/3 of an inning. After Brown finally managed to get the 2 outs to end the percussive treatment, he stomped off the field, kept going past Torrey, and marched up the runway to the clubhouse, shouting as he passed the manager, "I'm done." Torrey and pitching coach Mel Stottlemyre looked at one another as if to say, "What now?" Brown was infamous for his temper, but was quitting in the middle of a game really an option? Torrey turned and left the dugout, taking the runway and then the stairs that led into the visiting clubhouse at Tropicana Field. Torrey saw Brown's jersey, hat, and gloves strewn about the floor, but he didn't see Brown. He did see Messina sitting in one of the clubhouse chairs. "Where is he?" Torrey asked. "I don't know," Messina said. "Somewhere back there." He motioned toward a back room off the clubhouse. Messina had seen Brown storm into the clubhouse, fling away his jersey, glove, and hat, grab his cell phone from his locker, and disappear, snapping, "I'm done. I'm going home." Torrey followed in the direction where Messina pointed. He turned a corner and suddenly was stunned at what he saw. Kevin Brown, 40 years old, a 6-time All-Star, a 2-time ERA champion, a man who had won 207 Major League games and earned more than $130 million playing baseball, was curled up on the floor in a tiny crevice in the corner of a storage area in the back of the clubhouse. "What are you doing?" Torrey asked. "I'm not going to go out there and pitch anymore," Brown said. "What are you going to do?" "I'm going to go home." "You might as well go home." There was no response from Brown. Torrey continued. "Because just remember, if you're going to quit on these guys, you can't ever come back. You can never come back. Just understand that. What you just told me, that's what it means. If you're not going to go back out there, you can't even stay here." Brown wore that thoroughly beaten look, the same look he had 9 months earlier after he broke his left hand punching a concrete pillar. Meanwhile, the top of the second inning was in progress, and there was one out already. The Yankees would need somebody to pitch the bottom of the inning real quickly. Nobody was throwing in the bullpen. Nobody else knew what was going on with Brown. "Listen," Torrey said to Brown, Why don't you just get your glove, go back out there and pitch, and let's talk about it later. Brown stood up, walked past Torrey and into the main clubhouse. He fired his cell phone clear across the room in the direction of his locker. He picked up his shirt, his hat, and his glove, and he walked back toward the dugout. Kevin Brown threw 4 more innings, surrendering 2 more runs. He never did bother coming in to talk, Torrey said. He was banged up, but I think he had some emotional issues. There were a lot of demons in this guy. It was sad. The Yankees lost the game 11-4, and they lost again, and again, and again after that as part of a 1-9 stretch that dropped their record to 11-19, marking only the 5th time in franchise history they posted so many losses in the first 30 games. The other 4 teams to start so poorly turned out, in fact, to be horrendous teams. Those teams, from 1912, 1913, 1925, and 1966, all lost at least 85 games and finished out of first place by 55, 38, 28.5, and 26.5 games, respectively. Such was the inglorious company of the 2005 Yankees. There exists a mythology that the championship Yankees teams under Torrey operated on autopilot, blissfully riding their talent and their will to preordained titles. No team requires no care. Even the most beautiful garden in the world, as amazed and occupied as we might be by its natural beauty, is the work of hours of pruning and weeding and feeding and fastidious attention to detail. The championship teams required their own maintenance from, among others, the insecurities of Chuck Knoblauch, to the immaturity of David Wells, to the self-critical nature of Tino Martinez, to the overflow intensity of Paul O'Neill, to the neediness of Roger Clemens, and to the overbearing intrusion and influence of George Steinbrenner. Greatness is the ability to mask the difficulty of a task, to make the difficult appear easy. Those Yankee teams epitomized greatness. But the Yankees in the middle aughts made nothing look easy. They were rocked by organizational and clubhouse dysfunction that made the maintenance of a team a noisy, constant, and exhausting job, like keeping a belching, balky furnace going in the basement of an apartment building. The problems became apparent in 2004 because of the mix of players introduced and worsened in that 2005 season. Not 4 weeks after the Brown meltdown, Messina asked to speak to Torrey about what he perceived to be a lack of focus and preparation by some of the players. They went to lunch while the team was in Milwaukee. "I laid some things out," Messina said. "It was about players I thought weren't going about it the right way. The 05 team had some issues the first half of the season." What the Yankees lacked in talent, particularly when it came to starting pitching, was exacerbated by odd personalities and individual agendas in the clubhouse. The mix of players wasn't working, taking the Yankees further and further from the roots of their championships. "It's all a continuation of the end of the other group, the group that left after 01, Messina said. "After 01 we lost some guys, and after 02 we lost some guys, and after 03 we lost the pitching staff. Whatever semblance of that other team there was, it certainly was gone after 03. It started phasing out after 01, but after 03 it was just Derek and Posada and Mariano and Bernie who were left. Everybody else was new. The mix wasn't the same." Only days after Messina voiced his concern to Torrey, and on the same trip, still only 1 month after the Brown meltdown, another blow-up occurred. This time it involved Gary Sheffield and Torrey. As the struggling Yankees lost another game, this one in St. Louis, Sheffield appeared to loaf after a ball in right field. Torrey, unhappy with the general effort he was getting from his team, held a clubhouse meeting after the game in which he singled out Sheffield and rookie second baseman Robinson Cano for what he thought was a lack of hustle. In the days after the meeting, Torrey noticed that Sheffield was moping around him. He called him into his office. "Do we have an issue?" Torrey asked. "Yeah," said Sheffield, who explained he took exception to Torrey accusing him in front of the team of not hustling. "I was trying to deke the runner," Sheffield said. "Well, if you weren't loafing, I apologize," Torrey said, "because that's what it looked like to me. What else we got?" "Well, it was in the paper," Sheffield said of Torrey calling him out. "Do you think I told them?" Torrey asked. "I don't know," Sheffield said. I don't do that, Tori said. I wouldn't do that. Obviously it came from somewhere else. There were a lot of people in the room. I can't control that. There's no reason for me to go to the media with that, said Tori. He seemed to believe me, but he was always a suspicious person. 2 years later, speaking to HBO, Sheffield used that clubhouse meeting as evidence to support his opinion that Tori treated black players differently than white players. The only thing I ever wanted to do as a manager was to make sure everybody felt they were being treated fairly, Tori said. That's why when Sheffield said something, it really blew me away. Because I really went ass over tea kettle to try to accommodate him. If I had something he needed to hear, like if he brought his son into the clubhouse, which wasn't allowed, I'd ask Jeter to tell him because he had a relationship with him. If it came from a player, it didn't seem somebody was trying to tell him what to do again. At the time, I knew none of what he said was true. I just didn't want to fan the flames at that point in time. I had been around the game a very long time, so if there had been an issue, I'm sure it would have come out that I slighted people or didn't treat them right. That came out of left field. What the 2005 Yankees needed most of all to establish stability and a presence was an ace. They needed a shilling. The guy Boston general manager Theo Epstein successfully hunted to bring a kick-your-ass attitude to the Red Sox pitching staff. The Yankees were so sure they had that guy and Randy Johnson that their entire front office elected unanimously to pursue Johnson, who was 41 years old, rather than Beltran, a fleet, athletic, everyday player in his prime. They were dead wrong. Beltran had given the Yankees a last-minute discounted offer before signing with the Mets. Said Torrey, Cash said no, you can't have everything. Beltran wanted to come to us so he could hide among the trees. Nobody wants to be that guy to lead. That's what makes Jeter so unique in what he does. Alex, to his credit, wants to be that guy, but as long as Jeter is there, he's very aware of that. Johnson had thrown a perfect game, logged 245 and two-thirds innings, won 16 games, and struck out a National League-best 290 batters in 2003 with Arizona. He fit the profile of the stopper the Yankees so desperately needed. The statistical profile, anyway. He was, in fact, a sensitive, hyper-aware person who, in the growing tradition of Weaver, Contreras, Vasquez, and Pavano, was uncomfortable with the constant criticism and noise that came with playing in New York. Such awkwardness was apparent from his very first day, when he swatted away a news cameraman on the streets of New York while in town for his physical. I was in Hawaii when it happened, Tori said, and I talked to him on the phone. I said, do what you have to do. If you want to apologize, apologize. Just let it go. But that really wasn't his fault. They never should have put him in that situation. They should have put him in a car or a van and taken him to the hospital. That was our security decision. That was a bad decision. He really had trouble recovering from that, because all of a sudden now all this pressure was on him because people don't like him to start with, and he would read every single word that was written. Johnson was struck by two baseball neuroses that were amplified in New York. He fretted about what was said and written about him, and he worried constantly that other teams were decoding tells in his delivery to know what pitch was coming. They most certainly were not the typical qualities of a kick-your-ass staff leader. Johnson did not pitch all that badly in New York. He took the ball with regularity. From 2004 through 2007, only four times did a pitcher give the Yankees 200 innings. Johnson did so twice, as many as all other Yankees pitchers combined in those 4 years. He also won some games, posting a 34-19 record. But he was also hit too hard and was lost too deeply in his own cloud of worry to give the Yankees anything close to the vibe of being a true ace. In those 2 seasons, for instance, he gave up 95 and 114 earned runs, the 2 worst such seasons of his long career. His combined ERA in those 2 seasons with the Yankees was 4.37, which ranked an unimpressive 55th, among all ERA qualifiers in that span. The biggest surprise to me was how Randy Johnson could get rattled, Torrey said. I wish I knew this about him in the 2001 World Series when we played against him. You could rattle him. Every start with Randy it would be, this guy has my pitches, that guy has my pitches. There wasn't one team that didn't have a person that told him they were getting his pitches that he would take to heart. I mentioned it to Randy and I said, "It's not about the pitches, it's about location. Throw that pitch where you want it and you'll get them out." He was always so concerned about that. "Are they getting my pitches? Do you think they're getting my pitches? The guy hit this pitch." I'd go, "You just threw it down the middle. When they start laying off pitches they should be swinging at, then yeah." But he was the biggest surprise for me. He was probably the most self-conscious superstar I've ever been around. By far. Torrey spent hours with Johnson trying to make life easier for him in New York. He would tell Johnson that he shouldn't worry about criticism because, based on his prolific career, he could never satisfy fans in the media anyway. "You're not going to satisfy people unless you strike out 10 or 12 every game," Torrey would tell him. "Even if you win ball games, they're going to want to know why you didn't strike out more. So don't even worry about it." One day, Johnson came to Torrey with a newspaper in his hand. "Look at this," Johnson said. "This is my apartment. They have pictures of my apartment." "Randy," Torrey said, "why do you even look at the fucking newspaper?" Other times, Torrey would see so much passivity out of Johnson on the mound that he would tell him, "I need to see your teeth out there. You have to growl." Then Johnson would pitch a good game and say to Torrey, "Is that what you mean?" "Yeah," Torrey said. "Just do what you do like that and find out how good it is, that's all." And then it would be gone, the fire snuffed by something the newspapers or radio put out there about him, or that nagging worry that hitters knew what was coming. I brought him into the office. I'd talk to him in the trainer's room. We'd sit in the dugout, a number of places, Torrey said. It was sad more than frustrating because when we got him, I thought we finally had someone you could hook your wagon to, and that wasn't the case. The 2005 Yankees employed a pitching staff with an average age of 34.2 years old, making it the oldest staff in franchise history. They finished 9th in the American League with a 4.87 ERA. Their relative ERA, essentially a measurement of how they compared to the league average, was the Yankees' second worst in the previous 70 years, exceeded only by the 1989 club that lost 87 games and finished 5th. Bill James' Pythagorean formula pegged the Yankees, with that kind of pitching, as worth 90 wins, which would have kept them home for the playoffs, with the 5th best record in the American League. Instead, somehow, they won the AL East again with 95 wins. The Yankees actually finished in a tie with the Red Sox, but were awarded first place by virtue of winning the season series against Boston 10-9. The teams had split their previous 90 games 45-45. A clear pattern had developed. The Yankees' pitching was getting worse and worse, and the clubhouse becoming more populated with ill-suited stars, but Torrey still not only was getting these teams into the playoffs, he was also consistently getting these teams to overperform. The 2005 team was Torrey's 8th straight team that won more games than it should have been expected to win. Those teams outperformed Pythagorean expectations by an average of 5.25 wins. In a way, by somehow dragging themselves into the playoffs in the later part of those years, those teams were covering up what otherwise would have been even more obvious flaws. The Yankees had nothing close to championship pitching anymore, but they wore the same uniforms as the 1996, 1998, 1999, and 2000 Yankees, still had Jeter and Williams and Posada and Rivera and Torrey, still had the highest payroll in baseball, so therefore they were expected to simply show up and win the World Series as if nothing in baseball had changed in the past 5 years. They were bound to fail in November. The Yankees drew the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim in the Division Series, a series in which the Angels, who also won 95 games, held home field advantage by virtue of beating the Yankees head-to-head during the season, 6-4. After the Yankees managed to split the first two games in Anaheim, their season, fittingly, was funneled straight into the hands of Johnson, who would get the ball in Game 3, the swing game, at Yankee Stadium. The Yankees' answer to Schilling was abysmal. Johnson could not get so much as one out in the 4th inning. He faced 17 batters and gave up 9 hits. He left with 2 runners on base in the 4th inning, with the Yankees behind 5-0. All season he never gave off the real glow of an ace, and the reality was all too obvious in Game 3. "That's the game where you've got a decided advantage," Torrey said. and you've just got to go ahead and grab it by the throat. He just never seemed to be comfortable doing it. He never took the bull and said, "All right, guys, follow me." You never had the feeling that that was what you were going to get. There's no question that New York is a different place to play. Everything you do is magnified and criticized. He was uncomfortable pitching in New York. He's the one that's supposed to be intimidating. He pitched a horrible game, and it's like it didn't surprise him. It surprised Roger Clemens every time he pitched a horrible game. The Yankees, who could still bang the ball with anybody in baseball, hit their way out of the 5-0 hole and actually took a 6-5 lead into the sixth inning. But the Angels battered the Yankees' bullpen for 6 unanswered runs and won 11-7. The Yankees did send the series back to Anaheim by rallying to win Game 4, 3-2, with 2 runs in the 7th inning. But their pitching, old and creaky, caught up with them again in the deciding game. Messina, 36, bothered by a strained groin muscle, staggered off the mound in the 3rd inning, having put the Yankees in a 5-2 hole. They lost 5-3. Shortly thereafter, Stottlemyre quit as pitching coach, worn down by the fractious relationship between Yankees officials in New York and Tampa, the latter often choosing to intervene in Major League pitching matters. Stottlemyre also quit because he knew Torrey's relationship with Steinbrenner had worsened, and he knew one of Steinbrenner's favorite tactics to tweak his manager was to fire one of his favored coaches. Stottlemyre wanted out before Steinbrenner had the chance to use him as a pawn in his war with Torrey. Torrey, too, wasn't sure he wanted to come back to what the job had become. He knew, coming off the bitter 2004 ALCS defeat, that he had little favor left with Steinbrenner. The two of them had engaged in almost no communication throughout the 2005 season. The incidents of criticisms, second-guessing, and statements handed or leaked to the media had picked up. Torrey was bothered, too, that Yankees officials were feeding questions to Yes Network reporter Kim Jones designed to corner Torrey or to put him in an unfavorable light. The questions themselves didn't bother Torrey so much. It was the Torrey who built his entire relationships with people on trust, understood that the very people who were paying him to help the Yankees win were intentionally trying to undermine him on the team's own network. "I was getting paid to do a pre- and post-game show for the Yes Network," Torrey said. "And they took the fact that they paid me as an opening to tell somebody what to ask me and try to ask tough questions, which I don't know what a tough question is when someone is talking about the game. I mean, they ask you a question about the game, you answer the question. You knew she was uncomfortable asking certain questions about why you'd bring him in or why you'd do this. It just didn't match up." And then they admitted it. "Well, you're getting paid." They felt they had the right to do that, which is crazy in my mind. So after the season was over, I said, "Forget it. We're not going to do it anymore. I don't want your money. I'll answer any question you want, but let's not put a dialogue together designed to put me in a bad light." It was so obvious that it was all about trying to make me look bad. And I don't know what question was so tough anyway. If I had brought in a pitcher and he got his ass kicked, what's so secretive about that? Everybody saw what happened. I made a decision, and it didn't work. It's not like I said, "I have to make a decision. Let me flip a coin. Okay, I'll bring this guy in." Torrey went home and tried to decompress from a draining season. For a few days he spoke to no one in the organization and no one in the media. He didn't know whether he wanted to manage the Yankees anymore, in great part because he didn't know if they wanted him. After Torrey had done enough brooding around the house, his wife Allie said to him, "Why don't you go down and talk to George?" "You're right," Torrey said. He had not called Steinbrenner virtually all year, nor had he discussed his relationship with Steinbrenner with the media, and it was time to break the cold war and see if George really did want him back. "I disconnected," Torrey said. "I hadn't talked to him. It was all second-hand smoke I was getting, which was the worst." To keep the trip as quiet as possible, Torrey chartered a private plane to Tampa. Steve Swindell, the team's managing partner, asked Torrey if he minded if Randy Levine flew down with him. "No, not at all," Torrey said. Levine met Torrey at the airport. The flight was delayed. "Maintenance problem," Torrey told Levine. "The ejection seat for you needed to get fixed." They chuckled at the gallows humor. Levine told Torrey on the plane ride to Tampa, "We want you back." So Torrey's mood was brightened a bit by the time he walked into the meeting. Torrey and Levine joined Steinbrenner and Swindell. They met in Steinbrenner's office at Legends Field, with Steinbrenner seated at his desk like the captain at the helm. Torrey took a seat to Steinbrenner's left. "The only reason I'm down here," Torrey said, "is I want to see if you want me to be the manager." Torrey wasn't sure what reaction he would get from Steinbrenner to that opening. He had decided well before the meeting that if there was any hemming or hawing, or if they didn't want me, I would have said, "Let's figure a way out of this." Steinbrenner did not hesitate. "Yes, I want you to manage," he said. Torrey was relieved. "I can't work for someone if the only reason they're keeping me on is they're paying me," Torrey said. "I want to be comfortable knowing when I do things, they're on my side, that they're pulling for me to do something right." The rest of the meeting was quick and easy. Torrey did say that the disconnect between Yankees officials in New York and Tampa needed to be resolved. Steinbrenner agreed. Torrey also promised to call Steinbrenner every 10 days or so. "I'll make sure we stay connected," he told him. There was one loose end that required immediate attention, and though Torrey did not know it at the time, it would contribute to a rift in his professional relationship with Brian Cashman, and, by extension, to the beginning of his end as Yankees manager. The Yankees needed a replacement for Stottlemyre as the pitching coach. Torrey mentioned that his choice would be Ron Guidry, the former Yankees pitcher who had served as a spring training instructor. "I knew he hadn't done it before," Torrey said, "but he handled stress well. He did a lot of work in spring training." Guidry was nothing close to the kind of coach Cashman wanted, and Cashman's power in the organization was growing immensely. As the Yankees played poorly during the first half of the 2005 season, after the 11-19 start they were still a 500 team as late as July 1st, Steinbrenner rode Cashman mercilessly. "This is on you and Joe," Steinbrenner would warn Cashman. It was an old favorite tactic of Steinbrenner. He loved to make people individually responsible for the outcomes of others. It was designated scapegoating, and what Steinbrenner loved about it was that it kept those placed under his warning perpetually uncomfortable. He hated his employees to be comfortable. He wanted his people to be on edge constantly. The criticism bothered Cashman only because Steinbrenner made him accountable for decisions for which he had little input, or even argued against. Steinbrenner also loved the divide-and-conquer stratagem to keep his employees on edge. He loved pitting his lieutenants in Tampa against his soldiers in New York, for instance. The baseball operations people in Tampa might acquire somebody Cashman didn't fully endorse, such as outfielder Gary Sheffield or infielder Tony Womack. But it would always be Cashman whom Steinbrenner would hold accountable. Finally, during the early dark days of that 2005 season, Cashman decided he had had enough of the scoldings. "If this is really my team," he told Steinbrenner, "and I'm the only one fixing it, I'll fix it for the final time. That's it. At the end of the season, I'm done. I've been telling you the storm clouds are coming." Indeed, Cashman told Steinbrenner, as his contract ran out after the season, that he intended to leave because of the disorganization in the baseball operations hierarchy. Cashman wrote a chain-of-command philosophy memo to Steinbrenner, outlining exactly what the Yankees needed. Clearly defined job descriptions and responsibilities for the baseball operations personnel, with the general manager holding top authority. Steinbrenner said he would institute those changes if Cashman agreed to return. Cashman decided to stay, now fully empowered to run the baseball operations and to keep the Tampa lieutenants in check. While fixing the 2005 Yankees, Cashman introduced some youth. He promoted pitcher Chien-Ming Wang, who at the age of 25 gave the Yankees an 8-5 record, and second baseman Robinson Cano, who hit .297 at the age of 22. Cashman saw what was happening around baseball. His contemporaries and friends, such as Theo Epstein in Boston, Billy Bean in Oakland, and Mark Shapiro in Cleveland, were using cutting-edge evaluation tools and processes to put together efficient rosters from top to bottom. Cashman wanted to join the information revolution, but he knew he couldn't join in if old-time baseballmen in Tampa, such as Billy Connors, Steinbrenner's trusted pitching guru, could undo his carefully crafted plans with just one whisper in the boss's ear about some broken-down veteran he liked. His new contract removed that problem. The choice of the next pitching coach would immediately test Cashman's authority and philosophy. Cashman liked people with experience, and he liked people with strong organizational skills, with an understanding of statistical analysis, neither of which described Guidry. Cashman's idea of the modern pitching coach was someone such as Joe Kerrigan, the former Boston and Philadelphia pitching coach, whom he hired in 2005 to be his special assistant. Kerrigan pored over scouting reports, computer printouts, and videos to find any edge for the Yankees. The Yankees, with Steinbrenner influencing Cashman, first tried to hire Leo Mazzoni, who had plenty of experience and a proven track record with the Atlanta Braves, but who deployed an old-school philosophy. The Yankees were so close to a deal with Mazzoni that when Torrey called him one day, Mazzoni said, "All right, I'll be with you. I'm looking forward to working with you." "Good," said Torrey, who knew Mazzoni from when he managed the Braves. The next day, Mazzoni signed with the Orioles to work close to his hometown and with Baltimore manager Sam Perlazzo, a friend since childhood. Cashman then called up Torrey. "George wants to hire Guidry," Cashman said. "That's fine with me," Torrey said. "George wants to talk to you about it." Torrey called Steinbrenner, who asked him, "What do you think of Guidry?" "I trust him," Torrey said. "It's going to take some time. He hasn't done it on an everyday basis, but he's very thorough, from the spring experiences I had with him." Steinbrenner liked Guidry, and he always liked taking care of former Yankee greats. Cashman was a more difficult sell. Said Torrey, "Cash didn't want any part of it because Guidry had no experience. He likes people with experience." "I understand that. I was sort of in a tough spot because I know I had mentioned Guidry in passing when I had that meeting with George. I know Cash went to George about Guidry's inexperience because I know Billy didn't like Guidry. George, I think, hired him because he remembered me saying it." Torrey had an idea to try to keep both Steinbrenner and Cashman happy. "Cash," he said, "I know you're uncomfortable with this, so why don't you, with Guidry's lack of experience, bring Kerrigan on as the bullpen coach? Kerrigan will be right there to help Guidry with the administrative stuff." Cashman signed off on the idea, though Torrey knew Cashman still wasn't comfortable with an old-school guy like Guidry running his pitching staff. Guidry was one of the greatest left-handed pitchers in Yankee history, an ace under manager Billy Martin on championship teams. He worked hard, got along with everyone, but looked at pitching development from a different perspective than Cashman. Guidry relied not so much on computers as he did personal experience, which he liked to share with his pitchers. He remembered, for instance, once in 1977 when he walked into the clubhouse during a game in the third inning and saw Hall of Famer Catfish Hunter, the starting pitcher in that game, sipping a beer. "Cat, what are you doing?" Guidry asked. "Gator, on a hot day like today, I always drink a small beer while I'm pitching," Hunter said. "It helps me. I don't like Gatorade. Water bloats me. I come in and have a beer. Just during day games, not night games. It works for me." Guidry figured if it worked for Hunter, it could work for him. One day in 1978, on a hot Saturday afternoon, Guidry, who was pitching that day, sipped a beer in the clubhouse in the third inning. All of a sudden, Martin was standing in the doorway. "What the hell are you doing?" the manager asked. "I'm 11-0, Guidry replied. "What more do you want?" Martin immediately calmed down. "Go ahead," Martin said. "Take your time." Said Guidry, "Every day game from that point on, when I'd come in after the third inning, Billy would go, 'Are you going to the lounge?' I'd say, 'Yeah.' And he'd say, 'I'll be right back.' I look back on everything we went through. Sometimes I think that's why we played so well. Because it was so much fun." Cashman, though, was the kind of general manager who put his faith not in such folk tales, but in cold, hard facts, such as pitch counts and statistical analysis, the kind of stuff at which Kerrigan excelled. The thing about Cash, Torrey said, was any time you talked to him about him being a numbers guy, he really had very little patience about it. He kept denying it, and he got very defensive about it. When the 2006 Yankees spring training camp began, it was obvious that this was now Cashman's team. The first clues were the video cameras set up on tripods behind the home plates in the large bullpen area of the Legends Field complex. "We knew something was up in spring training when Cashman ordered every side session pitch filmed," said Borzello. Torrey also noticed that more and more people from the front office were trolling the clubhouse and coach's dressing room. Cashman had surrounded himself with up-and-coming assistants who were raised more on statistical analysis than heavy old-school scouting beliefs. They were young, smart, and diligent, and were comfortable, even jazzed up about discussing such things as players' VORPs, the acronym stat for something called Value Over Replacement Player, and in-house PlayStation tournaments. They brought a new perspective to talent evaluation that, of course, no more solved the eternal mysteries of baseball than the old-school scouting methods had. Midway through 2007, for instance, Cashman and his number crunchers zeroed in on trading for Wilson Betemit, a switch-hitting infielder with the Los Angeles Dodgers. The word excitedly circulating around the hallways of Yankee Stadium was that the Yankees had found the next David Ortiz. Not that Betemit fit Ortiz's profile as a slugger, but that his numbers suggested he was an undervalued gem who was on the cusp of a huge breakout, like the one Ortiz had for Boston in 2003. The Yankees were dead wrong. Betemit, plagued by extremely poor plate discipline and conditioning issues, was dreadful, posting on-base percentages of .278 and .289 with the Yankees over that season and the next. On the other hand, the new Yankee philosophy hit on such minor league free agent pitching finds as Brian Bruni, Jose Veras, Darryl Rasner, and Edouard Ramirez. Instituting the new groupthink in 2006, however, was not without internal strain. It got to the point where I was starting not to trust people, Torrey said of the 2006 spring training camp. There were so many other people Cash wanted in the mix. I got very suspicious. There were guys in the clubhouse and in the coach's room that weren't there before, like they were checking out what was going on. Cash would say, "We haven't counted this guy's pitches." There was always some information being sent back to Cash that helped him know everything that was going on, rather than trusting what the baseball people were doing. And of course, he was questioning Guidry. In spring training, it looked like Cash was doing undercover work to check up on Guidry all the time. A cultural clash was developing. Cashman, newly empowered, at last had the chance to run the team his way, and his way included a strong desire to hop aboard the information revolution. Torrey saw numbers not as a guiding philosophy, but as one tool in a manager's toolbox, particularly when it came to culling information from batter pitcher histories. Cash, once he was in charge, wanted to be as practical as possible, Torrey said. He put his trust in people he hired, like Billy Epler. Billy was fine. I'd talked to him at batting practice behind the cage. I remember one time we were talking about Kyle Farnsworth. I was suspect about his ability to sustain any consistency. The thing Epler came up with was, "I think it's a good signing because of the money." That's fine, but I'm trying to win games and put somebody in the setup position who's going to be consistent. Torrey and Cashman had been together for 11 years, the previous 9 as the most successful manager-general manager combination in the game. They had been through so much and, despite the difference in ages, had nurtured a deeply shared respect and a special kinship. If nothing else, both of them understood as well as anybody on the planet the joys and difficulties of working for George Steinbrenner. And that alone had the bonding powers of a 6-month deployment on a nuclear submarine. But the 2006 spring training camp opened a professional, philosophical gap between them that would never entirely close. One day during that camp, Torrey met with Cashman in the manager's office. "Cash, you've changed," Torrey said. "I have not," Cashman said. "I accused him of looking for reasons to criticize Guidry," Torrey said. "He had all his staff members around. He relied a lot less on opinions. He wanted documentation. That was more important." After that, the